Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Okay, now I get to do the fun part. Oh, that's so fun. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forums. I've been practicing that, where we connect your intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.com/inforum. I'm Bob Sutton. I'm your moderator. I'm the author of Scaling Up Excellence. And tonight we get to have the Kelly brothers, Tom and David, and they're going to talk about unleashing your creative potential, something both have been doing and studying much of their lives. Tom is a partner at IDEO. He's the author of multiple bestsellers, including The Art of Innovation and 10 Faces of Innovation. David Kelly is the founder of IDEO, one of the world's leading innovation firms and also design firms. He's also, it says, the creator of the D School. I would say he's the heart and soul and driving force behind the D School, which has been an amazing experience I've experienced with them. Both Tom and David are iconic innovators in their own way. I've had the privilege to watch them work together and even driving together. They're so bonded as brothers. It's absolutely unbelievable. And this year, just a few weeks ago, they came out with a brand new book called Creative Confidence, Unleashing the Creative Potential Within All of Us. It's a great book. In fact, I've read it twice in the last month and was even better the second time, so I highly recommend it. And I think that's enough of me, and let's get to the main act. So let's start out with the brother thing. So I'm just thinking of trying to write a book with my sister. It just seems impossible. So how do you do it? You guys have worked together. How many years have you worked together at IDEO?
26
years, and they were brothers in Ohio before that, of course. And now you've written this both this great book. So how do you do it?
Well, you had it left out that we were raised in the basement of a Midwestern house where he and I, our bedroom was in the basement. So for the first 14 years, I'm 4 years older, so the first 14 years we shared a bedroom. So that's a good start to being, to dealing with your brother. So the genesis of the book, and then he and I, and Tom and I doing it together, was that in 2007, I got the bad news that I had throat cancer, and they gave me about a 40% chance of living. And so that'll straighten you right. I highly recommend the diagnosis of a terminal disease. Don't get a terminal disease, but if you could be convinced that you had one, it would really change your perspective on the world. And but I had one for real, and I survived, just so you can tell, if you can see I survived, which is cool. But Tom was there every day for me. It was we were very close, and he was there all the time for me, taking care of me. And as we got near the end of that ordeal, and it was clear that I was going to get through it, we decided that we'd do two things. One, we would travel together. We hadn't traveled. When you're partners at IDEO, you probably go in different directions. You don't go to the same place. It's overkill for two partners to go to the same place. So we rarely travel together. And so we went on this lovely trip to Japan, which Tom's a kind of a Japan-phile, even marrying a Japanese woman who's sitting in the front row. And so we had a lovely trip to Japan. But we also decided that we would do a project together. We're not very good at leisure, being kind of Midwestern, workers. And so we decided that we would do a project together. And the project that we decided to do is this book that is here in the building today. So that's how it got started.
So, Tom, what's your perspective on this?
Well, you know, a part that David left out there, I think, was, we were 4 years apart, which... I was going to say, if you have kids, many of you are too young to have kids, aren't you? But we're just think about your siblings. 4 years is enough. We were never on the same Little League team. We were never in the same school, really, in middle school or high school and stuff like that. And so just enough separation that we basically never, even as very young kids, we never competed, right? And then we went these very circuitous routes, very different routes in our career, and kind of ended up together at IDEO. And so I think that helps a lot, that we were different enough that we, we just, like, there's not kind of an insecurity or a competitiveness, and that has really helped us a lot. This was a very intense project, and so that kind of trust, I mean, there's a element of love here, right? We trust each other completely, and that helped a lot in the tough days of the project, because 2 years, 7 days a week. I mean, the idea percolated for like 4 years on the back burner, but 7 days a week, you get tired, and I don't know if you know anybody who gets cranky when they're tired, but, I do, and that's sometimes me.
Spanish teacher in high school liked him a lot better. She told him by the time he got to her, she said, I like you a lot better than your brother, David.
As a result, my Spanish way better than David's.
Well, you're more conscientious in some ways. So speaking of the book, what all those couple of years of suffering, what's your favorite story about writing the book?
So, a favorite moment in the piece was, because when we started, I mean, we just wanted to do a project together. It almost didn't matter what it was. And so, we decided we'd do this creative confidence thing. And I was still not sure about it, And so we went out and we did 100 interviews. And, wow, I want to do more. I mean, we're going to keep collecting stories because being in the room with the 100 people that went through this process we call flipping, which is to say they went from not self-identified creative to self-identified creative, and these people glow. I mean, it is fun to be around them because in getting to this state of creative confidence, it's not just that they, say, yeah, I'm creative, and it's way not that. I mean, you just hang around them, they take on bigger challenges, they have more, like, resilience when they run into obstacles. They have more perseverance to see something through the end. And so it was really the interviewer's ease who won me over. That was my favorite part of the project. And so we're still through, we've got a hashtag creative confidence. We've got this open innovation challenge. We're still collecting those stories all the time because, really, that's the most fun.
So Tom has sort of implied it, but David, how would you describe what creative confidence is? I think Tom's going to have some hints.
Creative confidence, yeah. We look at creative confidence as this kind of natural human ability to come up with big ideas, with breakthrough ideas, and the kind of, kind of courage to act on it. It's the combination of both. It's kind of like your definition of wisdom.
So you can steal my ideas, David.
I always steal your ideas. But it's this balance between, what happens to us is that somewhere along the line, after kindergarten, think about kindergarten. Everybody's wildly creative. I mean, I have a picture in my kitchen that my daughter drew of a chicken with four legs. Totally proud of that picture of the chicken, right? With four legs. But by the time you get a little older, by the time you get to fourth, fifth grade, teachers are saying that's a terrible chicken, and so people opt out of thinking of themselves as creative. And so our whole role is to try to understand how you get the people who, the kind of world's divided into creatives and non-creatives, especially like in ad agencies and places like that. And so we're trying to make people understand that they're naturally creative, and they really are. I mean, lessons we've learned at the D School is we can basically flip almost anybody. And so it's that kind of natural kind of creativity that we try to bring out. And then people trying to hang back. I mean, so many times we see in companies and in groups of all kinds that if you kind of identify with an idea, you have this idea, and if you put your name on it, then bad things can happen. Oh, that was Bob's idea and it didn't work, and so it's kind of a stigma, Bob. And so the organization is set up to not encourage people to take chances and do that. So this creative confidence, this feeling that these people have that we've witnessed at the D School in particular, is that they have that, they understand that they have that.
David, why don't you tell them what the D School is? Because everybody might not know what the D School is.
Sorry. The D School. I mean, like when you live something all the time, it's hard not to remember. D School is technically the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford. So what happened was that I had this notion with teaching with people like Bob and others that going away from my, the university is kind of organized in these silos, and so most of my early career, I taught only in my department to only students in my department. And then after I got tenure and fooled around with like Bob and other people, I started seeing that the students that came from different disciplines, when they worked together, they had this kind of sparkle in their eye, and it was really, I thought it was really exciting. And I really think I saw a phenomenon. I witnessed this thing where people like really gained confidence from working with other people. So I went to Stanford and said, you know, I think this is a good idea. We should, you know, codify this and make it a part of the university that people work in multidisciplinary ways, and that I think this design thinking stuff, the way that designers think, will be a good way to be the glue to hold them together. And they thought it was a really nice idea, but that was it. A few years later passed, and then I was in the office of one of IDEO's biggest clients, who's a guy named Hasso Plattner. He's the founder of SAP. And he said to me, well, we were talking about things, and he said to me, oh, I'll help you with that. So I went back to the university, and I was telling this story to people, and they said, look, you're blowing it. When a billionaire says they'll help you with something, you should call him right back. So I got back to Hasso, and the long story short, Hasso funded the whole thing, so that's why it's called the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design. And it's been this amazing ride to go from, a few students a year, like bringing their parents up to me at the end of school and saying, oh, thank you very much, to like hundreds of kids who are so emotional that they're now owning this creativity in their bodies. You know, that they used to think of themselves as only analytical, and now they think of themselves as both analytical and creative. And they always have, it's funny, they all have the same story. They're trying to justify it biologically because they still believe in the paradigm that it must be biological. So they say, I always knew I was creative. You know, my uncle was an architect. You know, that's how I got the gene that makes me creative. But it turns out that everybody's wildly creative. So we have students from all seven schools around Stanford that come and they work together on really interesting, difficult projects. We don't pay the faculty. Bob can tell you that.
I complain about it, but I keep coming back. It's true.
We don't give degrees. A lot of the classes you don't get credit for. Everybody who's at the D school wants to be there, right? And so it's a really lovely place.
And so no one, of course, expects David to be objective about the D school. He founded it. He helps run it and things like
I'm
that.
I'm objective.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. Anyhow, so, you know, I'm not a Stanford guy at all. I'm a Berkeley guy, right? And so, yeah, go Bears. And so I really, I had a little bit of skepticism going into it. And no kidding. You know, I told you the 100 interviews, many, many, many of them were from the D School or went through the D School, either as students or in the executive ed programs. And it was jaw dropping. I mean, it was. I'm a huge fan of it now. I mean, it's just the number of lives being changed as people go through it, and then they go on to change lives. So
why don't you tell us since it's kind of funny because it's sort of the insider and outsider perspective. So you collected all these stories. What are some of your favorite stories about creative conflict?
Oh man, okay. So there's 100 stories, right? You know, like hard to pick. So okay, so here's. Yeah, so here's one. There's a guy who, his name is Doug Dietz, who's a really sensitive, wonderful guy. He works for GE Healthcare. He designs those huge medical scanners, you know, the MRIs, the CAT scanners, things like that. And Doug is proud of his work. You know, he's part of the healthcare system of America. He's part of the healing process. And he's really happy. And when he finishes one of his machines, he worked 2.5 years on it, and he gets a chance to see it in use in a local hospital, right? The big corporations call this voice of the customer. They get to go talk to the customer and find out how they did, right? And so Doug goes, and he thinks his customer is the technician who runs the machine. And so he goes and he asks her a series of questions. And Doug, looking back on it today, is so embarrassed. He said, every single question I asked her was about me. He said every question was, did you notice this new feature that we built into the machine? Did you notice this new thing? Have you used this part of the machine yet? Right? And he says, I ask all my questions completely self-satisfied. I'm ready to leave because I got all the information I think I need for that day. I'm going to go back and tell my team how wonderful the new machine we designed was. Right? And he stood up. He's on his way out to leave. And as he's leaving, a patient comes in. a young girl, and she's there with her mom and dad. And the girl's crying, and the dad is saying to her, as they pass by Doug, the dad is saying, "Now remember, honey, we talked about this. You can be strong, right?" And Doug just can't figure out, based on all the data available to him, he can't figure out what's happening here, right? Because he's just asked a bunch of questions about the machine, like, why is somebody crying, right? And so he asks the operator, and she says, "Oh, Doug, you didn't ask me about this." She said, "Your machine scares the heck out of kids." She says, "You know, to be honest, Doug, the kids can't go through the procedure." She says, "More than 80% of the pediatric patients, we have to get them anesthesia so they can survive the experience of using your machine." And Doug, who's like one of the most sensitive guys on earth, he cries
more than any man I've ever met in my life. He does. No,
no
he does.
Kidding. So in the story that I've just told you, he would have already cried three times.
That's right.
You watch him. He's got a TED Talk. You watch him, and you count how many times Doug cries, right? Doug has a personal crisis. You know, he goes back and tells his wife that he might have to change careers because, you know, he was part of the healing process, and now he's in charge of making big machines that make, you know, kids cry, right? And, like, this is not a happy moment for Doug. And so Doug, you know, can't keep this to himself, and he tells his boss about this crisis, and the boss sends him to D school, right? And remember, I'm a skeptic. Like, sure, if D school, it's just like miracle cure. Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, Doug spends a week executive ed, right? So he's not a graduate student. He's just there for a week-long course. But he's with people from all different companies. He's the only one there from GE. All different companies and all different disciplines within the companies. And they practice this design thinking stuff. You know, it starts with empathy and humans. And then you prototype and you learn from all your prototypes. And then you pick ideas and you wrap a story around them and things like that. And while he's there, Doug comes up with an idea he's going to take back home and use, right? And he knows he can't redesign an MRI machine because that takes 2 years and costs millions of dollars and there's all those regulatory approvals. He doesn't redesign the machine, he redesigns the experience. He collects together all volunteer group, no support, no budget from his company at the time. All volunteer group, it's somebody from the Children's Museum nearby, it's from that children's hospital, it's volunteers from GE, and they don't redesign the machine, they redesign the experience. They cover the machine with decals and, you know, graphics that turn the machine and the whole room into like an adventure. In fact, it's now called the Adventure Series. So there's a pirate ship adventure and there's a spaceship adventures and stuff like that. And a really important part of redesigning the experience is they wrote a script for the operator. Right. And so the script for the pirate ship one says, "Now, Johnny, you're going into the pirate ship today, right? And when you're inside that pirate ship, you got to stay perfectly still because if you move, the pirate will find you. You think you can lie perfectly still?" Yeah, I can lie perfectly still. And they do. And so at this hospital where they were anesthetizing more than 80% of the patients, it goes down below 10%. Right. And so, you know, win, 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 right? GE's happier because their market share goes up and they sell more machines, right? The hospital's happier because they process more patients, right? They reduce the cost of healthcare at the same time. Because I don't know if you've ever been in a hospital and called for the anesthesiologist, like, you know, in the delivery room, for example. They are not waiting in the hallway outside the room, right? It's like 45 minutes. So they cut out that whole step. Right, and so the hospital's happy, and Doug says, "Everybody's got their metrics." He says, "I don't care about those metrics." He says, "Here's my metric." He says, "I go back." Now I can see Doug crying. It's choking me up. He says, "I go back." He says, "I don't talk to that machine operator." He says, "She's got nothing for me." She says, "I talk to the patients. I talk to the parents." He says, "I'm back in that same room talking to one of the moms one day." He says, "I'm talking to the mom about aromatherapy." So Doug has this idea, not yet implemented, this idea that they're going to spritz pina colada smell inside a scanning suite, right? And I said, "Doug, really? Pina colada? I mean, do kids even know what a pina colada is?" And he says, "Oh, no, Tom, not for the kids. It's for the parents." He says, "The parents are stressed out, and it's stressing out the kids." He says, "My theory is that pina colada smell triggers a relaxation response in adults," right? And I think he might be right about that, right? So he's there talking to the mom about pina coladas. And her little daughter, this like 6-year-old girl who's just been scanned, comes up and tugs on her mom's skirt a couple of times until mom looks down and says, "Yes, honey, what is it?" And then this girl who's been just scanned in Doug's machine says, "Mommy, can we come back tomorrow?" So he says, "Let them have their metric. This is mine." He says, "Can we come back tomorrow?" So there's 99 other stories, right? Imagine that, you know, the experience of talking to 100 Doug Dietzes. It was really fun.
I'd like to also ask David what his favorite story is, but just two comments about Doug, who I saw about 3 hours ago. He's actually taken the week off and teaching other executives design thinking at the D School. He's coaching a group, and one of the projects he's working on is non-compressive mammography, which is so it doesn't get smashed. And the women know exactly what I'm talking about. And if they can solve that problem, they not only will make a lot of women happy, they'll sell lots of them. It's back to the human needs.
Sure, and Doug epitomizes this thing with creatively confident people. But Doug's job has totally changed. He's the ambassador for these ideas across this giant corporation. He's at the D School as, you know, essentially faculty teaching other people.
Yep.
And so when these people have creative confidence, it changes their whole lives sometimes. It certainly changes their careers.
David, what's your favorite story?
Well, I don't know. There's lots of them in the book, and there's lots similar to that, the flipping of an executive or flipping of a student. The cathartic moment in the book for me in an interview was with a psychologist at Stanford called Albert Bandura. If you don't know who Albert Bandura is, if you go to Wikipedia, he's on the list of most important psychologists. He's right after Freud and Skinner and a few people like that. He's the fourth. You got to believe Wikipedia, right? I mean, he's the fourth most important. He's the most cited psychologist in the U.S. alive. And psychologists care about who has the most citations, trust me. Anyway, and so I went to see him, and in talking to him, he's been working in the area of like phobias, his book is called Self-Efficacy, and he defines self-efficacy as the sort of sense that you have a sense of what's going on in the world and that you can accomplish what you set out to do. How much do you have that feeling of being able to be, effective? And I'm talking to him. He's 86 or 87. Seemed like a young guy to me. And I realized, oh my God, that's creative confidence. It's the same thing. He's been doing the same thing. We're kind of bouncing around in the dark, just trying different stuff, and we've come up with the same thing. And so we could then use all of the kind of scientific studies that he'd done around self-efficacy and use them to kind of improve our methodology. So the big breakthrough there is that he could label the kind of stuff that we do. And the process that let's say about phobias. So he's curing people who have phobias like snakes and spiders. You know, these people are staying inside their house, not going out on hikes and stuff because they're afraid they might run into a snake. And he has a near 100% cure rate and only in a few hours. And he uses a methodology called guided mastery. And it turns out that's exactly what we do with our students and with our clients. And so guided mastery is where you help the person that you're trying to relieve their fear in a series of small successes. So in the case of snakes, he has them stand at he tells them there's a snake in the next room, which they don't like. Then he has them stand at a mirrored window, and he sees them inside. He puts their friends inside, and they're hanging with the snake, and he's standing in the door. I mean, there's 1,000 mini steps. I mean, I'm going to make it shorter than go through. And then they're in there with welding gloves on, you know, and eventually they touch the snake, and it changes their life, and they're cured. Well, we have the same thing, only our fear is the kind of fear of being judged by other people or fear of failing. And we do the same thing. We take students and clients through a series. We give them a small project. We help them be successful at it. And they do another one and another one. And the projects get, more difficult as they go. And in the end, they flip and they say, oh, my God, look how creative. Look at this breakthrough that my team's come up with. And it changes them. So that moment in talking to Bandura made it clear to me that we were onto something that wasn't just our random fooling around, that it really fit. I'll tell you the funny story about the Bandura experience was, so I'm going to have to give this TED talk after a few months after this, and I'm and I'm going to tell this story about the snake. And so I call Al and I say, hey, can you send over a picture of that room with the snake in it? I had never seen pictures of it. So he sends them over, and I'm thinking this boa constrictor wrapped around somebody. It's a garter snake. It's about this big, you know. It's very small. We're on radio. This is, you know, a very small snake, a gardener snake. It fits in a shoebox. And I'm so disappointed. I didn't use this picture, but, you know, I guess if you're fear of snakes, it doesn't matter how big the snake is, I guess. But anyways, that was a big deal.
I want to get back to the creative confidence thing, because one thing that I know for many of us is that there's a lot of people out there who feel like they're in jobs where it stifles their creativity. And creative confidence sounds sort of like a pipe dream in some ways sometimes. So what advice do you have about people who are in jobs where they feel like it's difficult to be creative? Sure. Like, so how can creative confidence help them? What do you suggest?
You mean besides by the book, right?
Besides by the book, yes, of
yeah,
course.
Sure. So, I mean, one thing, you know, there's a lot of advice in the book. There's a whole chapter about tactical, you know, things you can do. But one thing, you know, people just out of school and, you know, trying to prove themselves, what we find is young people who've just started a company, they're completely on our side. A lot of times when I'll speak to a group of young people, their first question is, how do I sell this to my boss, right? And as a practical matter, you know, your boss may be quite skeptical. And so one of the techniques that we talk about in the book, and we're not saying it's easy, it's not, is double delivering, which is, give the boss exactly what they asked for using the traditional methods, the spreadsheet, or whatever it is that they wanted you to do, and at the same time, use a design thinking approach. You know, go out and hang out with your customers and figure out something new that maybe your boss either doesn't remember or never saw, right? Or whatever. But use a parallel method and then present both, right? And you won't necessarily succeed the first time, but if you do this a few times, the boss, you know, you can win them over. Because even skeptical people, they like success. And if you show a methodology, you know, an approach that comes with, you know, with a fresh idea, they'll still like it, even if it's not the approach that they would have used. But that gets at a theme that runs through the whole book, which is, we're not saying this is easy. We're saying that you might have to work harder, but if you have passion about it, it won't be that difficult. There's one of my favorite small stories in the book is a young guy who worked for us who wanted to be a professional musician, and when he was in high school, and he got to go. He was at this huge concert with Yo-Yo Ma, you know, performing, and he was one of three kids in this room with, you know, more than 1,000 people. He's one of three kids that got to ask Yo-Yo Ma one question. This young guy named Eric, he loved to perform. He didn't like to practice at all, you know, as sometimes happens. And so when he gets his one question for Yo-Yo Ma, his question is, and Eric laughs as he, you know, tries to tell us, you know, this story. But his one question was, isn't it wonderful now that you're a professional musician that you don't have to practice anymore? Right? And Yo-Yo Ma says, Eric, I have some bad news for you. Right? As you may know, 6 hours a day. You know, a guy who's at the very top of his field, 6 hours a day. It's not easy being Yo-Yo Ma, but he loves the work. Right? And so it's that way as well for, you know, for people with creative confidence is, it can be hard, and it can be fun in the process.
So I just realized we've been talking about design thinking for about 20 minutes now. Yes. Maybe we should tell people what it is. So, David, you're supposed to be one of the modern inventors of it, so I think we should turn to you.
Okay.
That's what you told me anyways.
Design thinking is a kind of approach we use. It's the way designers have always worked. It's a methodology. It's a process. And it really involves is... So, if you think about, there's a lot of ways to do innovation, and it's really a combination of all of them. But lots of companies and individuals do innovation through like coming up with a new technology and then kind of pushing it into the world and hoping that people accept it. Or they come up with a kind of a business idea. This is a clever way to make this something viable, and then they hope that people will accept it. And we kind of go the other way. Design thinking is, let's try to understand what people really value, what's really meaningful to people. And then we'll take the technical and the business risks that we can come up with something that satisfies that need. We call it need finding. So much of the world is talking about problem solving. And we think that that one of the really creative act is what project is worth working on in the first place. Then you can do the problem solving after the fact. So design thinking is really an approach which involves really having deep empathy for people. We have this thing called bias towards action. So many of our projects in companies and so forth start with a kind of a planning phase where everybody kind of sits in a room and they have their laptops open and they, you know, like, but they don't know anything. They haven't been out in the field. They have no visceral feel for what's going on in the project. So we kind of skip the planning phase. We do that later, by the way, but we jump right in and try to build real empathy for the humans that are involved, the users, the customers, so to speak. And so that deep empathy then leads to a phase of kind of coming up with prototypes. You know, we call them crummy prototypes because if you build a really good prototype, nobody will help you. But if you have a prototype that's kind of half-baked, everybody will tell you what's wrong with it, and you can go back and fix it over and over again, right? And so, you know, we kind of do that kind of, we get inspiration from building things and showing them to people and then rebuilding them, right? And then the final part of it is really about storytelling. It's really about trying to paint a picture of the future with our idea in it. In the past, we would, you know, if we were designing a product, we'd design a product and we'd put a cloth cover on it and pull the cover off and everybody go, ooh, look how beautiful that is. That was the role of the designer. But today, with design thinking, what we're doing is we're making quick videos, we're making stories about the experience of what the future will be like with this new hammer in it, this new mallet in it. And so you get all of the human issues as well as the kind of physical and aesthetic issues. And so design thinking is kind of that methodology. The wonderful thing about design thinking is that for us is that, as I said before, this we think diversity of the people in the room or the talent on a project is the way to come up with breakthrough ideas. Because if you put this really diverse group of people together and then have them find a way to work together, you can come up with, by definition, new ideas. If you have a room full of all engineers, they're going to come out with the same kind of engineer, but if same kind of idea. But if you have a room that's got an engineer and a psychologist and a philosopher and a lawyer and a geologist in the room, and then you get them so that they can build on each other's ideas. You know, I have an idea, and then they think, oh, how about this? What about this? You, by definition, it's easier to get to a breakthrough idea because that kind of group has never worked before. And so what worked out for us was that the way we've always worked, which we're calling design thinking, is a methodology. Because it's so human, we were able to get these diverse groups to sign up to this methodology as opposed to we tried multidisciplinary stuff.
So David, I mean, one thing that might be interesting for folks is maybe you could talk a little bit more about the empathy phase, because at least I was raised in a kind of business sort of background, and then David and others taught me empathy. Like, so maybe talk a little bit about that, because it sounds strange, but it's amazing how you've turned it into such great things in people that eSchool have in IDEO too.
Yeah, well, empathy, sometimes we call it need finding, sometimes we call it the empathy phase, but when you're, you know, my mentor, Bob McKim, who kind of taught me a lot of this stuff, said, a fish doesn't know he's wet. I thought that was always a good expression. But is that, you know, so many of the kind of well-respected, successful companies really don't have a visceral feel for where their products are stored in the home or what the people really care about. And so this deep empathy you get from actually going into their homes and observing them rather than asking them questions. You can't ask them a question. They can't tell you about what new products to do, whatever. But if you watch them, you see where they have trouble. You watch them use a piece of software, and when they're grimacing at a certain part, all you have to do is correlate where they are in the software with when they were grimacing, and you know there's a problem there, and you can rebuild it. I mean, there's just it's just the diving in and really getting to understand people in a real close way.
And a part of the reason that the empathy phase is so important is because humans, for the most part, from our experience, they lack the ability to tell you about the breakthrough idea, right? You say, well, you know, what can we make better? They say, oh, could you make this a little smaller, a little cheaper, you know, things like that. But they won't say, you know what I need that doesn't exist in the world, right? They have trouble with that. They can't identify sometimes their own problems. There's a story in the book of an elderly woman who were sitting, it's our team in our Munich office, sitting in the living room with her, and she's got rheumatoid arthritis, which you may have seen, you know, it limits her dexterity. And we're talking about those pill bottles, you know, that she has to open, you know, because she's elderly and she takes a lot of meds. And we say to her, how's that work for you? Getting the pill out of the bottle, any problem? And she says, no, pill bottles don't give me any real trouble, right? And so imagine you're there, you're writing it down, right? Or usually the way that would arrive at, you know, if you're doing data collection, that would be in the survey response that arrives at your desk, right, because you haven't gone out in the field, right? And so what would you be tempted to conclude? Maybe the pill bottles don't give her any real trouble, but that would be wrong because she is lying to you, right? Because we're there and we're looking at her hands and we're looking at that little tiny pill bottle and thinking, no, I don't think so. And so we say, well, look, could you show us? And this is the thing with empathy is you observe, you watch, you know, ask the follow-on questions. Could you show us? And she says, oh, sure. I mean, because she doesn't think she's lying, right? And she picks up her little pill bottle and she leads our team into the kitchen, at which point she approaches the meat slicer, right? And she takes this little tiny bottle and she's got this hand with these gnarled fingers and she is a millimeter away from that spinning blade as it slices the cap off of that bottle, right? She doesn't have a problem. What problem? Me? Right? And so, and our team is like recoiling in horror, like, you know. And so people don't raise their hand and tell you. They think they're fine, right? But if you observe, if you ask the follow-up question, if you ask them to show you, wow, you will see stuff really every time you will see stuff.
So, I mean, a great IDEO story that I like is that for those of you who had little kids or were little kids where there's a point where they jump up and down, they want to move their legs but they can't walk. The device they used to have that hangs things from the door jamb, and then actually an IDEO team went and observed young parents dealing with the kids jumping up and down, and it was great in terms of the empathy work. They figured out that the moms were worried that the thing was going to fall on the kid's head and hurt him, and the guys were worried that the door jamb was going to get scratched, and that's true, and that led to one of their most successful products, the Jumperoo. I mean, that's incredibly successful. Product.
Fisher-Price.
I'm sorry, the Fisher-Price jumper. We have to say the name of the client. One thing that I was sort of thinking, we've been talking a lot about the stories in the book and the experiences in IDEO, but you guys have been pretty busy. You've been all over the place. They were just on Charlie Rose last night, so they've been pretty busy. And you've been hearing a lot of new stories. So for those hundreds of stories, anything new you want to share?
Sure. This is the great thing. It doesn't stop here, right? I plan to keep collecting these stories for the rest of my life, right? And so the one really cool thing, like the day after we got the hashtag Creative Confidence, in comes this video that probably many of you in this room have seen. She labeled it herself. It's a young woman named Karen Cheng. She labeled her video, Girl Learns to Dance in a Year. Anybody seen this video? Anyhow, joyous. So first she taught herself to be a designer, but that doesn't appear on the video. Then she created this video, and you see her, you know, it's starting in like day four, and she's really, really bad as a dancer, but she sticks with it, and she goes all the way through. And so, you know, day 365, she steps off a BART train, and she's really, really good, right? And so just to see, and you see her kind of confidence emerge over the, it's only a 2-minute video. You see that happen. And so we just presented down in Art Center down in Pasadena, California, and there's Karen, you know, sitting in the front row of the audience. And so we have her whole story now, right? And I said to her, darn, if we'd met you 6 weeks earlier, you would be in the book, right? And so, it is our hope to, you know, help other people gain creative confidence, but it's certainly our hope that we'll you know, get more stories like Karen Cheng's.
She also taught herself to draw.
Yeah.
And she just got a book that said draw in 30 days, and she went through it 4 times, and now she's an accomplished designer, basically.
Yeah.
Cool.
So another thing that I thought would be sort of interesting is we're talking about other people's creative confidence, but you two, and they are incredibly different as brothers. I've known them for a long time. And they've had different journeys. Maybe you could describe your own journey to getting your own creative confidence, since I know you both have pretty interesting stories in that regard.
Yeah, so I was your normal, difficult kid growing up, taking everything apart and not putting it back together. One of the moments was I was 12, I got a new Schwinn bicycle. It was red. That was the 25th of December. 26th of December, I took it out, sandblasted it, and painted it fluorescent green. You can imagine your parents who just invested in a beautiful red bicycle are not that thrilled, but, I mean, they let us get away with it. But that was my, you know, I was a builder and a maker of things and a kind of classic design kid growing up. But I was from Ohio and a family of basically blue-collar people other than my father. And so my favorite subject in school was art. I was president of the art club and all that kind of stuff, but if you're a Midwestern boy, you can't really go into art. So I went into engineering, and I got an engineering degree, kind of. But I
MIT, Carnegie Mellon, a real school.
But,
yeah.
I went to work in corporate America, and I was just a terrible engineer. I was one of those people who was. Kind of working during the week so I could have a good week, an enjoyable weekend, you know. That's kind of a professor at Harvard talks about a job or a career or a calling, and I definitely had a job. And what happened, though, was in the gas crisis in 73, I put up a sign at Boeing. I was working at Boeing at the time, and I put a sign up that said, you know, I need somebody to carpool, and this guy answered the carpool, and to my great serendipitous wonderment, he had gone to Stanford in the same program that I'm now the head of. And he said, you're perfect. He kept telling me, you're perfect for this program. He and I were making, you know, contraptions and stuff, and you're perfect for it. I said, look, you can't understand. I'm not going to get into Stanford. My grades are terrible. I was a terrible engineer. And he kept pushing me. And so I applied and I got admitted because my mentor, this guy Bob McKim, could tell that I was a good fit, and so I got in. That allows me, by the way, now to admit anybody I want since I'm running the program.
You're gonna be careful; you're gonna get a lot of applications.
Yeah. Right. But anyways, it was that moment where I got confidence. I started, instead of the bottom of the class at Carnegie Mellon, I was the top of the class at Stanford. I started to realize that I could do this. There was something. It was design. It wasn't engineering. I was just off about 15 degrees from the right calling. And it became to my excitement, it became this thing that I just gained this confidence. And so that led me to, you know, start companies and do that. But it was that. And so I probably do more damage in office hours than I do in class at Stanford. I'm teaching three classes right now, but office hours, you know, students come in and you can help them. And I always try to help them, like, understand that the object is not to find a job that looks good and feels bad. So many of my friends have a job that looks good to their parents or to the society, but it feels bad every day. And so that's about fit. They're just not, they don't fit in that job. So I spend so much time with my students trying to find fit. So my creative confidence came from finding my fit in a kind of a career kind of way.
What about you, Tom?
Sure. You know, there's people who insist on dividing the world into creatives and non-creatives. And if those people followed David Kelly around through his entire childhood, they'd say, yep, see, he was born creative, right? Because he was like an art student from kindergarten. He stuck with it from kindergarten all the way through high school. Whereas I was completely the opposite. You know, Dave was like playing in a rock band and wearing cool shoes even back then. And I, you know, like kind of played it straight. I got an MBA. I worked for an accounting firm just down the street from here. You know, and so I worked as a management consultant where we basically showed up for work and did spreadsheets all day. Right, and so I'm in my 30s at that point, and I would say no visible evidence of any creativity, right? But then I came to IDEO, and you kind of learn by osmosis, right? And so if I can flip, you know, from where I was at, you know, age 30-something to here, I think it's possible for anybody. I mean, I think I have evidentiary proof, right? So I think there's, for some people, there's more hope in my story than in David's, because it's like, yeah, first be born really creative, you know, but it's there. It's in everybody. I mean, it is buried deeper in some people than in others, but a part of the message of the book is, wow, you can totally do this. You have to decide. You have to be willing to put in a little effort. Because, you know, it's like learning, you know, people say, well, I can't draw. Well, yeah, you can't play the piano either until you had a couple of lessons, right? Yo-Yo Ma didn't know how to play the cello until he got some, you know, got some help, right? And so it's not like it should be that easy, but you can do it. You can totally.
So can I tell my story of John Cassidy?
Say no.
John
Who's John Cassidy no at this point?
No, John Cassidy started a company called Klutz Press. you know, this thing where they make books for kids that have different things attached. And John's a great guy. His first book was called Juggling for the Complete Klutz. That was his first book. And it's a really great lesson about this kind of getting rid of this fear that you're not creative. And so I got his book. I didn't know John there. He now teaches at Stanford, and we're buddies. But at the time, I didn't know him. And I thought it'd be cool to juggle. You know, you go to the parties and impress the girls because you could juggle or something. Anyways, and so I got the book. And the first half of the book is all about the drop. It's all about desensitizing you to dropping the ball on the floor, right? If you think about it, that's what's keeping you from building the coordination is you're constantly fear that you're going to drop it. So you kind of get wound up in that emotion of like, or fear of dropping it. And so really the first, like you spend the whole time, I mean, you're juggling a couple of hours, but the first hour is just dropping the ball on the ground until you get desensitized that. And then it's actually a pretty straightforward ability to juggle. It's not that difficult once you're not worried about dropping the ball, right? And so this fear that people have that they're not creative is not well-founded. And if you just get through that, desensitizing that sense of that somebody's judging you or that you're going to fail in some way that's unpleasant, it's pretty straightforward.
So first I've got to make an announcement. This is for the audience here. So we're going to be going to Q&A in a few minutes, so in about 5 minutes. So we would suggest that you start lining up at the microphones now. So there's a microphone there and there. And this is the most important line I'm supposed to read. A reminder, we're looking for single one-part questions. No lengthy setups or multiple-part questions, please. And the staff at the Commonwealth Club don't know me, but I will enforce this rule. All right, so let's go back to the questions. We've just got a few minutes left. We've mostly been talking about the past and the present. What's ahead for you guys? Since they are different, but they're these sort of hardworking Midwesterners, and they can't help themselves. So maybe I'll start with you, Tom. So what's the next adventure?
Sure. I mean, I think the next adventure is this adventure, right? Because, yeah, the book is out, right? And so, gee, so glad to have that that project done. But that's if you think of that as capital C creative confidence, there's still small C creative confidence, which is trying to get people in the world to, you know, to have more creativity in their lives. You know, we've worked a very long time in the field of innovation, right, you know, 30 years or so. And so we're not going to stop working on innovation, but I personally am really interested in working on innovators, right? Because, you know, in the innovation space, it's not 100% success rate. You know, some of those innovations fail. I hate that, but, you know, it happens, right? Whereas if you can make new innovators, if you can inspire new innovators, you know, sure, they'll have some failures too, but they'll have successes. And so I think it is a worthy task to figure out how we bring out that creativity in other people. Adobe, the software company, did a study last year they called State of Create. And they asked people about creativity and economic growth and things like that. But then they asked this question, how about you? Do you have a chance to live up to your creative potential? And this is in five countries, 5,000 people, and 75% of them said no. I don't have a chance to live up to my creative potential. And so I think this is a worthy life goal, is how might we unlock the potential of the other 75%, right? And so I think that's what's next.
That's pretty worthy. So, David, before we get to Q&A, what's next?
Well, I mean, certainly want to double down at Stanford and graduate as many kids as possible that have confidence in their creative ability. And so we have the sanction of the higher-ups in the university, and we're going to work on that. But my own passion is basically K-12. And so IDEO has a big K-12 group, and the D-School has a big K-12 group, and it's a real mess. We're doing a fabulous project in Peru to reinvent the school system of Peru, and it's building lots of schools and learning a lot. And we just finished a project for San Francisco Unified School District about improving the experience of lunch. And we believe that kind of stuff can make a big difference. Lunch is, lunch is more a social thing than an eating thing for kids. And so if you can make a fabulous social experience, then slip a little lunch in, you're better off. And you know, solutions like serve them family style and give them the vegetables first when they're hungry so they'll eat the vegetables. And so there's lots of ideas that you can come up with for some of these really interesting problems in K-12. And it's very hard. It's a very hard problem. But our approach is to get a bunch of little brush fires going in different places, and hopefully those brush fires will add up to a big forest fire, and we can do some real good in the K-12 space. That's my bias.
All right. So go to questions now? All right. So before we go to questions, I'm supposed to read this. As a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum. That's us. Connect your intellect. For more about InForum and its upcoming events, please visit us on Facebook or follow us at InForumsSF on Twitter. And tonight we're hosting IDEO's Kelly Brothers, Tom Kelly and David Kelly, and they've been talking about unleashing your creativity in their new book on creative confidence. So now let's turn to the questions, and remember the rules, short, single question.
You did a good job of reading that, Bias.
This is coming out of my head. The woman here on the right, you're first.
Hi, I'm Marie Applegate. Just want to say thank you to you guys. Since I'm keeping it short and all that stuff, I guess I'll just get right to the point. And I believe empathy is an exchange, and creative confidence is an exchange of energies as well, and feeling each other's energies. And I guess I would like some of yours. Can I get a hug?
She wants a hug. We can't see this on the radio.
It's radio.
We'll give you a hug. Can come later. Up and hug her? Give her a quick hug,
this
David.
Is just
be good.
For me.
Okay, we better go to the guy on the left while the hugging continues. So there's an on-the-air hug. It's actually happening, I know.
Imagine. Theater of the mind.
Theater
imagine
of the mind, yes. Okay. The next fellow. So for the radio audience, there's a hug going on between David Kelly and the audience member.
There you go.
So that's empathy work.
Both of us? Oh, jeez.
More empathy work.
That makes it a two-part question, I think.
That is a two-part question. Okay, radio audience, this is live empathy work. Double hugs, the two Kelly brothers.
Okay.
Yes, the fellow on the left. We can't do hugs all night, though.
Okay. I've been reading about Gretchen Westreich working in the area of innovation with technology in the healthcare sector. In context of current events, I'm wondering what the status of IDEO's impact on a national and a global scale on bringing technology to improve healthcare.
Sure. Well, we're deeply involved in healthcare. It's a super special industry. You know, like there's this, you know, you work on a kind of a higher plane in healthcare than in some other areas. And we're approaching it both from medical devices and healthcare services, right? And so medical devices, we worked last year on this. There's this company called Scanadu. I don't know if you've seen this, that wants to recreate the tricorder from Star Trek, where, you know, you scan the body. And they're not fooling around. I mean, they are moving in that direction. And so there's some really cool things happening on devices. We make a lot of surgical tools. But, you know, for a lot of us, you know, the technology, it's like the Doug Dietz and his, MRI machine. It's not necessarily the technology that has to be changed. It's the healthcare experience, right? So we work with the Mayo Clinic, not on clinical care at all. They're very, very, very good at clinical care. We work on the patient experience. You know, we work on new, service delivery, because if you've been in a hospital, you've seen opportunities for improvement, right? And so we are very interested in that.
We went into hospital and in this empathy phase, we said we wanted to pretend that we had heart attacks, and they wouldn't let us do that. So they let us pretend we had broken legs. And then we put video cameras up to our heads and went around, you know, in the things. And so we have hours and hours of ceiling tiles, you know, in the thing. And so nobody really asked why we had video cameras in our heads, because I don't know.
Well, that was the other interesting part, is nobody asked why somebody lied.
Right.
You think about that. The woman on the right here, yes.
Hi, I'm Daisy Pistuline. So I think I've been long-term inspired by you guys, so thank you for that. I think creative confidence is kind of two different things, right? It's about the confidence to be creative. Mm-hmm. But then once you have that creative idea, there's a lot of people with great ideas that don't do anything. So what is your advice on how to take that next step to actually bring it to fruition?
It's basically in the storytelling. You have to be able to paint a picture of the future with your idea in it, right? So it's compelling to the boss, the society, or whatever. So it's real. I mean, we do lots of things, but the main thing is in the storytelling, you have to put the person who's viewing it into the shoes of the person who's affected. So you say, meet Bob. You know, he's a 32-year-old, you know, skateboarder, and here's, you know, here's how he checks into the, here's how he gets his, how he rides from San Francisco to Palo Alto on the train or whatever. So yeah, so painting that picture such that people, and this is what I do with my students. I just had, you know, 80 students do videos this week of, you know, their ideas for how to do certain things. And so, it's really a story. After you have the big idea, it's really a storytelling problem so that you can inspire other people. It's so wonderful now that we have this with ease at which people make videos and tell stories that, you know, having the courage to put yourself out there in this way. And it's just so much easier to get your point of view heard today. Yeah, much
so,
better.
So, I mean, one of the things we've learned in the behavioral sciences is that statistics show that stories change behavior, not statistics. So there's even some evidence for that. The fellow right here.
Yeah. Hi, David. I'm Coleman Rusnak. Thanks for coming. I feel like I know a lot more about your background from Stanford and the experiences that shaped IDEO from the West Coast, but I was wondering if you could elaborate more on your time at CMU. As a fellow alum, I've always been curious how you made that transition and, you know, what inspired you there.
Yeah. So I went to Carnegie Mellon because it had a really great balance between the kind of arts and the kind of technical, right? I mean, people think of Carnegie Mellon as computer science, but they really have a great, even in the computer science program, the kind of combination of that and media and Hollywood and all, they're very good at that. So I went there because it had that balance, right? I was so buried in the technical stuff that I didn't get this. I mean, I took jewelry classes and stuff, and so it was in that way. My daughter's in the process of looking at colleges, right? And you tend to quickly look for places like CMU or Stanford, where there's both that kind of analytical brain and the creative brain are kind of exercised in that way. So I had a wonderful experience in Pittsburgh as a studio musician, and it was a big town for me, the big city. But Carnegie Mellon's become one of the things that's nice about when your university gets better than when you were there. I mean, I was there in the 70s, and now people say Carnegie Mellon. Well, I don't think Carnegie Mellon was as big a deal as it is today when I was there. The thing, I'm obsessed with the thing because I have a daughter who's looking at colleges. I think the thing that kids miss is that there's so many universities where you can have a great experience, right? And we kind of, this whole thing about getting into these big name things, it's way overblown. I mean, the serendipity of who you meet, and there's some fantastic teachers at all these different places. And so I'm not so hung up on the name of the place, but there's some really interesting places that I think you can be happy and excited in lots of different places.
Yeah, you know, you look at David's, you know, path, and it all kind of makes sense in retrospect, but it was not like there weren't, you know, like some moments in which it wasn't obvious what was going to happen next. So, you know, I was still in high school when David came home after junior year as an electrical engineering student and said he wanted to quit the double E program and become a fine artist, which was going to take him an extra 2 years to finish. And you'd imagine in small town Ohio, where your dad is a double E, you know, like, wow, that was not a popular idea, right? And so basically the answer was no, got to finish, right? I actually think IDEO got started because of, you know, the seed of IDEO got planted that day. It was like they were just struggling between the art and the, you know, engineering sides of life.
Question over here.
Hi, good evening. Thank you guys so much for sharing your insight. So one of the things that stuck out to me was how you stated redesigning the experience, specifically with just increasing minority participation in technology. How do you basically just redesign your thoughts on increasing participation in tech, specifically for maybe women or individuals of color, your thoughts on just how do we look at that? Because I feel like we're doing old things to get new results.
Yeah, most of the times that minorities are not well represented or is that the companies or the individual doing the design have not understood what's meaningful to them. Just from a business point of view, they're big markets, right? I mean, how could you stand not to understand what's meaningful to them? You know, we recently did a project, one of the D School projects in Africa about fire prevention. And so we were looking there for fire prevention. When we went and actually talked to the people, they weren't worried about fire prevention. They were worried about losing their documents, that their documents were, you know, like that the document allowed them to be in that building and to stay in the country and all that. And so whether it's minorities or any group actually having that, so the end result of that project wasn't fire prevention. It was going around with computers and scanning everybody's documents and making them comfortable, putting them up in the cloud and making them comfortable that they just think about how different is your life if you're not worried about losing this piece of paper and how important it is. But when we do a project, we look at all the stakeholders in a different project. So if you leave anybody out, if you leave anybody out of understanding their role in the situation, we did a lot of work with hospitals where the nurses had very low status, right? And that was a problem. That was a problem because they had lots to do with respect to the creative part of the all. They had all the knowledge and they knew what to do. And you know, they were a minority in that they were not talked to, right? And so, trying to get to all the stakeholders in any situation results in the big ideas.
Okay, question right here.
Hi, thank you both for being here tonight. I especially want to thank you, David, for your comments around K-12 education. And I work for Adobe, the creative software company that you mentioned earlier, and I work specifically in the education team looking at what's happening in K-12. And there's a lot of diversity, a wide spectrum of from great to pretty sad, as you mentioned. In your dream world, what would it look like in order to unleash student creativity? What
that's a big question, right? I mean, I have my own bias. There's so much written about this. I'd just be repeating other things. But, an education that in public schools, I focus on public schools, and an education where you understand the different learning styles of kids, you know. I mean, like not delivering it in the same way. There's all the studies in the Khan Academy stuff where, you know, kids that were seen as underachievers when given more time and taught in the way that they could learn turned out to be the big time achievers and they weren't and stuff. So, there's the whole Apple, one student thing. And I think it has a lot to do with customizing the experience for the kids and understanding the way the kids work. And I think I'm not a big proponent of a lot of the technology stuff, but I do think that online learning, if it can help kids learn the way they want to learn, and then much higher touch in the classroom because you've gotten some of that out of the way. My own personal bias is, the most viewed TED talk ever is Ken Robinson's talk, and he really makes this notion really about that. You know, this is going to sound self-serving, but it's Ken's talk, which is that having the kids being able to bring out their creativity is as important as literacy, and I really believe that belief at the IDEO and the D School has a lot to do with empowering kids. That, this self-efficacy that Albert Bandura talks about. If you think about the social emotional stuff is just as important as the reading, writing, and arithmetic. And so in the school, in the dream, if I had to paint a picture of the future, social emotional learning and that kind of stuff would be equally as, often you meet and figure out what's going on as often as you would taking a technical class.
All right. So it's time for our last question. And it's an informed tradition to ask all speakers the following easy question. What are your 60-second ideas to change the world? Tom, you got 60 seconds. Change the world.
60-second idea to change the world. What would that be? One thing would just be this idea of deciding to be creative. We talked to one of the interviews was a guy at Yale who spent his entire career studying genius and creativity. And he said, all of those creative people he talked to his whole career, they had one thing in common, which is at some point in their life, they just decided to be creative. And he said it's not always the default setting for the adult brain. You choose creativity, and then you act upon it. And so everybody has that power, before you leave the room. You can choose it, and in doing so, it's, one of the prerequisites for getting to creative confidence.
40 seconds, that was amazing. Okay,
I can do it less than that. That everyone through Everyone through guided mastery does the equivalent of touching the snake.
That's it. You're done. All right. So I'm Bob Sutton, and I'm doing the closing. So thank you. Before I close the program, I want to remind the audience that there's a reception and a book signing in the library immediately following the program. And those of you who hear this on the radio can also buy it on Amazon and other places. Now let's have a big round of applause for Tom and David Kelly for sharing their thoughts with us tonight. Now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is officially adjourned. 1, 2, 3, we're done. All right.